Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy.
As we get started here in the lesson, I have a question that I want you to reflect on, and that is, I wonder, have you ever made a purchase that was worth a lot more to you than the price that you were required to pay? Like, have you ever bought something and when you drove away or when you took possession or when you received, you know, that order in the mail or whatever it was, you thought to yourself, I needed this so badly. I wanted this so badly. I would have gladly paid double what they were asking me to pay for this. Sometimes it's something real serious, you know, like I can remember times early on in our parenthood journey where I'd be sitting in the 24-hour drive-through at Walgreens, you know, like trying to pick up a pharmacy order for a sick kid and thinking to myself, boy, in this kind of situation, I'll go wherever I have to go. I'll do whatever I have to do, and I'll pay whatever needs to be paid for me to get the medicine my kid needs. But sometimes the situation is like more fun. Like when you find out that your favorite band is getting back together or coming back to town or something, and you have the chance to get tickets, and you're like, boy, I would do whatever it takes to be at that show, you know? Sometimes you like find some reason that you just think, man, that is worth it to me to pay whatever they're charging. You know, how many of you have TSA pre-check, you know, because if you're a frequent traveler and you're thinking to yourself, I don't want to stand in that long security line and do the shoe thing and all of that every single time I have to go out of town for work. And so sometimes those kind of splurges seem worth it to you. I saw a news story this week about a business person in Hong Kong that paid this week $960,000 for a private parking space near their office building. Like, that kind of money is just unbelievable to me to think about, but to them and in that circumstance and that situation, that was worth it to them. And we've all got our reasons for the purchases that we've made, and I bet we could learn a lot about ourselves and each other if we were to, you know, pay attention to kind of our priorities and how we spend our resources, looking at the stuff that we buy without thinking about the price tag. I mean, we'll open up our wallets and loosen the purse strings for the right kind of experience or the right kind of tech product or whatever it is that really captures our imagination, the kinds of purchases that we think to ourselves, that's worth it, you know? And what's worth it to you may not be worth it to me. Sometimes we are going to disagree on that. We'll all have different priorities and different interests. There was an interesting story out of Houston this week about a locally famous furniture salesman who goes by the name Mattress Mac. And I know if you've had any familiarity with Houston in the last 40 years, you probably know who this guy is. He's famous for his TV commercials and for his community engagement. But the big news this week was that he had offered a promotion in his furniture store that said, if the Astros win the World Series, we will refund the purchase price of all of these mattresses that we've sold in the year 2019. And they had sold about $20 million worth of these mattresses that he was talking about. And so the whole city was like excited about this because, you know, it was in the news and there was a lot of buzz about it, and the Astros actually made it to the World Series. And so, I mean, in effect, it's like he was betting against the Astros because, you know, if the Astros won, he was going to lose big money. Now, he's a fan of the Astros, but he's also a really savvy business person. And so he calculated his risk, and the story takes a little bit of an interesting turn because about a month before the Astros made it to the World Series, Matt traveled to casinos in Mississippi and Nevada and New Jersey, and he placed $13 million worth of bets that the Astros would win the World Series. He was hedging his bet so that if the Astros won, his casino winnings would offset the losses he was going to take on the mattresses. And then it turned out the Astros lost the World Series, and so he was out the $13 million that he had bet, at the casino. Now, he wasn't upset. He was still smiling. He seemed really pleased about the whole thing. And when you ask him about it, what you find out is that, number one, he's keeping the money that he made on the mattresses, you know, so that helps. But number two, he says there's a marketing firm that he works with there in Houston that has estimated that the publicity he received over the promotion and then all the news coverage about the bets is worth over $8.5 million all told. And so this guy has, I mean, he lost about $4 million net if you don't include the mattress sales, but he says, I'm going to do this again. We'll probably do this every year. And to him, he says, this was absolutely worth it. It was worth losing the bets. It was worth investing the money. It was worth taking all the risk because of the decisions and the priorities he had made about connecting with his customers. I mean, for him, he said, this was worth every bit. Now, that's hard for me to relate to. But I know that for you, you're making decisions for yourself too about like what's worth investing yourself and your time and your resources in. This last week during Halloween, I was intrigued as I looked around in my neighborhood and saw all of the trouble that people had gone to decorate their property for this holiday, right? I mean, I've got neighbors who spent hundreds of dollars to transform their yards into cemeteries and haunted houses and spiders webs, and they've got fog machines that are running all night and laser projectors and sound systems. And when I'm out on my morning jog, I keep getting scared by these animatronic figures that are talking to me all out of nowhere, you know. A lot of these neighbors have elaborate costumes of their own. And so when the kids are out trick or treating, like they're hiding in the bushes or hiding in some dark corner and scaring people, they've spent hundreds of dollars on this stuff. And they bought candy and they bought snacks for all of the kids who were trick or treating. But that wasn't enough in my neighborhood, because in my neighborhood, there were also houses who were providing like food and adult beverages to the parents who were walking around. And all of you are thinking, what neighborhood do you live in? I want to come next year. You know, like these people have invested a ton of money. And I'm talking about people who don't normally even wave to each other on the sidewalk on any other day of the year in our neighborhood, right? Like I'm talking about they have invested hundreds of dollars for strangers because they decided that for them, spending that kind of money on that experience was worth it. And this morning, I want to get you thinking about what kinds of investments and what kinds of purchases and what kinds of causes are worth it to you. I want to get you thinking about the patterns of spending and the patterns of sharing in your life, because each one of us has different priorities that we're willing to spend on. We all have different causes that motivate us and that tug at our hearts. And I think that it would be really wise for us to identify what those motivations are. I think we ought to reflect on a couple of questions together. What is it that motivates me to spend? And what is it that motivates me to share? And I think based on some of the things Jesus had to say about money, the answers to those two questions, what is the motivation behind my spending and what is the motivation behind my sharing, the answers to those two questions may be the best way to get an accurate reading of your own spiritual health. Now, for the last couple of weeks, we've been in a series together that we've called Thankful. And this series is all about what it takes and what it means to live a life of contentment. And the reason we're talking about money during a series about contentment is because I'm convinced that one of the keys to finding contentment in this life involves finding peace with your relationship with money. One of the essentials to being able to be content in this life requires that you make peace and come to a peaceful place in your relationship with the money that you control, which is why I want to show you this morning a story that is buried. It's an obscure story in the Old Testament portion of your Bible, but this story is all about God's people and their relationship to their wealth. So if you got a Bible with you, you can open up with us. I'll give you some instructions on how to find it. We're going to be in the book of Exodus. But last week, if you were here, you'll remember that I shared part of a story with you from the days early on in the history of the people of Israel. And they had recently, as in 40 years before, They had been freed from being slaves in Egypt, and they had been nomads in the desert for 40 years as God was guiding them on where to go. But this morning, we're going to go even further back in time, back to the beginning of that 40-year period, and right after they had been freed from their slavery. Maybe you remember from some movies you've seen or from your own personal study that the story of the Israelites leaving Egypt, we refer to it as the Exodus, and it's in a book that goes by the same name. And the first half of this book is all about the Israelites getting out of Egypt. It's about the process and the experience and how God intervened and God showed up and God made all of these things happen to the Egyptians that convinced them it would be in their best interest to let the Israelites go. The second half of Exodus is all about their first few weeks and months out in the wilderness on their own and what happened as they began this new connection, this new relationship with God. Because once they got out past the Red Sea, once they got out into the wilderness and the Egyptian army was not chasing them anymore, once they got out there on their own, they started getting hungry and thirsty and running out of resources. And every time God kept showing up and God kept providing. And when an army came and tried to attack them from just some people who were fellow nomads out in the desert out there, God protected them, even though they weren't soldiers and they weren't equipped. And so God kept showing up. And then after some of those experiences kept stacking up and happening, finally God said to the Israelites, he said, I want to take our relationship up a notch. He said, I want to invite you into something new. And so God invited them. God proposed to the Israelites and invited them into a covenant relationship, kind of like a marriage between God and the Israelites. And through his messenger Moses, God told the Israelites this. He says, if you will just trust me, if you'll trust me and obey the things that I ask you to do, and if you'll forsake and ignore all of the other gods that are out there, all of the other gods that other people claim have power, and if you'll just focus your attention on me, if you'll just be devoted to me, he says, I am going to turn you into like a beacon for the rest of the world. I'm going to let the rest of the world see how incredible it is when you live in faithfulness to the one true God. And they're going to see it because of how blessed and how incredible this connection allows you to be. God says, I'm going to turn you into a kingdom of priests through whom the rest of the world will come to know me. And the Israelites were like, yeah, sign us up. Like, we want to be a part of that. So they accept the invitation, and God starts communicating with Moses and laying out the plans and laying out the agreement and laying out some of the rules and the laws that they were going to live by, including the Ten Commandments that you've probably heard something about. And there's some other laws that talk about how they were going to worship and how they were going to relate to one another and what social justice would look like among their community and how they would behave and interact with other people. But then God also provides this other unique set of instructions. He says, I'm going to ask y'all to build something. I want you to build a structure, a portable structure that's going to stand in the center of the camp, in the center of your encampment, in the center of all the tents, wherever you go. And he says, I'm going to come and live there. My presence is going to be made manifest inside this structure, and it'll always be a reminder to you that I'm with you and that you live in the presence of the Almighty God. And this structure, God had really specific plans and instructions, elaborate instructions for how to build it. It's supposed to be called the tabernacle. It was going to be made out of fine cloth and furnishings inside of it that were made of gold and silver and bronze and gemstones and animal skins. And I'm telling you, it's got this like laundry list of supplies that are supposed to come together for it to be built. And this is not stuff you can just find laying around on the side of the road out here in the desert, right? Like, he's talking about, I want luxury items that even today would be considered really expensive stuff. He says, I want you to build this structure out of gold, silver, and all this other luxury stuff. And you think to yourself, well, how's that going to happen? How are they supposed to start mining? Are they supposed to start like raising cotton? What's going on? But amazingly, if you back up a little bit in the story, you find out that God has already prepared them for this moment. You find out when you look back in Exodus chapter 12 that these recently freed slaves are carrying with them a treasure trove of expensive goods that they don't have any other need for at the moment. Because in chapter 12, it says when they were packing in a hurry to leave Egypt, God told the Israelites through Moses. He says, tell the Israelites to go trick-or-treating. He says, tell them to go next door to all of their neighbors' houses, all the Egyptians, and knock on the door and say, hey, can we have some of your stuff? And it says, the Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. And the Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked for. And so in the process, the Israelites plundered the Egyptians. It says that God had set it up at this point where the Egyptians were so ready for the Israelites to go and this series of plagues to be over and for this, good riddance, get out of here, take whatever you need. And so the Israelites have all this treasure with them, and God is asking for a structure that's built out of the very types of valuables that they have with them. But there's this twist that God doesn't demand that they give up their gold. He doesn't require that they hand over their silver and bronze. He doesn't force them to give up their yarn and their linen and all of these other expensive items. God doesn't force anybody to part with their possessions. Instead, He invites them. He invites them to come and be a part of this project. He doesn't say, you have to do this. You have to bring the gold and put it here. He doesn't say, I'm requiring you or else I'm going to leave you and you won't be blessed. He doesn't say any of that. He invites them individually to join in this project and make their relationship with God a priority in their life. And so God instructs Moses to say this to the people. Everyone who is willing. Everyone who's willing is to bring to the Lord an offering of gold and silver and bronze, blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen, and the list goes on and on and on. But what you see here is that God was not using guilt, and God was not using force, and God was not making somebody feel obligated. He was inviting people into a relationship and into a covenant. He was inviting them to reciprocate the same kind of connection, the same kind of engagement, the same kind of moving toward one another that He had already been instigating in their relationship. And what I want you to see what happens next, because we move on to this next chapter, chapter 36. This story is kind of extended throughout Exodus, but Moses starts collecting and distributing to the craftsmen all of these free will offerings that are supposed to go toward the building of the tabernacle. And chapter 36, verse 3 says, the craftsmen received from Moses all of the offerings that the Israelites had brought to carry out the work of constructing the sanctuary. And then it says, and catch this, it says the people continued to bring free will offerings morning after morning. The text says the offerings just kept coming. Like people kept bringing more stuff. Everything just kept coming in. And finally it gets to the point where the workers, the craftsmen, are not only overwhelmed, but they're oversupplied. And verse 4 says, all of the skilled workers, the people who are working on the gold, the people who are sewing the fabric, the people who are building the scaffolding for the tent, all of these skilled workers who were doing all the work on the sanctuary walked off the job. They left what they were doing and they went and tracked down Moses. They said, Moses, we got a problem. The people are bringing more than enough for doing the work that the Lord commanded to be done. Moses, the job site is getting way too cluttered. We don't have room for all of the extra gold. We don't have room for all of the extra silver. We don't have room for all of the olive oil. We don't have room for all of this stuff people are bringing. We don't even have room to work at this point because the people have been entirely too generous in giving to this cause. We've got more supplies than we're ever going to need. And so Moses has to send out an order to the people. Moses, it says in verse 6, gave an order, and they sent this word throughout the camp, where he said, no man or woman, nobody, is to make anything else as an offering for the sanctuary. Y'all got to quit, he says. And so the people were restrained from bringing more. Which is an interesting choice of words to me. Because in my mind, it conjures up a picture of people like having to block folks from trying to get into the drop-off station, you know, where Moses and all of his, like, assistants are like, I'm sorry, you can't come in, take all of your gold back home, we're not receiving that today. And I've got to tell you, I know a lot of people who help lead churches and nonprofit organizations, and it's really rare for leaders to have to restrict donations like this. It's really unusual for leaders to have to, you know, nix generosity. It's uncommon for leaders to say, please don't donate anymore. But this passage says that the people had to be restrained. They had to be held back. They were turning people away. And I imagine it in my mind's eye, all of these people showing up with, you know, donkeys that are weighed down with the donations they want to make. And they get to the donation center and they're like, hey, y'all were open yesterday and I brought stuff and y'all were taking all of this. What do you mean you're not taking anymore? I got to carry all of this back home. Because these people are practicing a level of generosity that seems unnatural. It's abnormal. It's not only unusual, it's probably unheard of. And when you think about who these people are, these former slaves, recently released slaves who had, I mean, just a few days ago, they had very little control over their lives and their futures. And now they're in possession of the kind of items that can buy them influence and comfort and a sense of security if they'll just hold on to it. I mean, they could hold on to it and wait till they get to the promised land or wait till they come across a caravan of traders or wait till they meet some people at some oasis or something and they can trade for things and they've got some power because they've got some resources, but they're giving it away. And you got to ask yourself, why would they do that? Why would they part with this stuff? Why would people give like this when they don't have to? There hasn't been a rule made. God was inviting people. It said everybody who's willing. Why? What would motivate this kind of generosity? What would make them feel like this was worth it? And I believe the answer is found when you read backwards in the story. I believe if you want to know the answer to why they would do this and what made it worth it and why they would be generous to this level, you have to read back in the story because I think that's what they were doing. I think they were beginning to recognize everything that God had done and everything that God was doing and everything that God had promised. And they were putting the pieces together. And I believe that there were husbands and wives who were sitting in the tents out there in the wilderness and they were talking to each other and saying, honey, we've got all this silver. What do you think we should do with it? They're taking collections up here, but it's just like a, you know, whoever wants to participate kind of thing. And as they were talking it over, they remembered. They remembered that feeling of panic, what it was like to be backed up against the wall at the Red Sea and to have the Egyptian army chasing them and nowhere that they could go. And suddenly God intervened. And I think they remembered what it felt like. Maybe they could vividly remember the feeling of when their stomachs were cramping and their throats were parched and there was nothing to eat and there was nothing to drink and suddenly God showed up and made water appear where there was no water and food showed up where there was no source of food. God reached down and provided, and I think they remembered. And I think they remembered the fear that they felt when the Amalekite army came over the horizon. And here were the Israelites, not trained, not equipped to be soldiers. They're terrified. They don't have anywhere they can run. They're just out in the open country. There's nowhere to hide. And then they remembered that God had shown up and somehow protected them. They remembered where they'd been. They remembered what they had been through. And they recognized that God had saved them from every danger. And it motivated them to show gratitude and generosity back to God. They had this song that was resonating in their minds and their hearts. You're never gonna let me down. You know the song. That's what they're thinking. God, after all we've been through, after all you carried us through, after we walked through the sea on dry ground, after you eliminated the Egyptian army right in our sight, the most powerful army on the planet, after everything you've brought us through, we're starting to believe, God, that you're never going to let us down. And they developed this generosity that was rooted in the generosity of their God. The generosity of godly people finds its source in the generosity of God, who was generous first. This is our story. This is the story of God's interaction with humanity, is that God was generous first, and humans get to be generous in response. In fact, I think generosity ought to be one of the characteristics that distinguishes the people of God from everybody else. And part of it is the reason. Now, you and I know there's lots of generous people in the world who don't know anything about God's love for them, right? There's lots of people in the world who are generous because they just care about suffering. There's people in the world who are generous because it gets a big tax write-off. There are people in the world who are generous because they know it gives them a reputation that makes them admired among other people. There are lots and lots of reasons to be generous. But I think one of the things that ought to distinguish the people of God, it ought to be our generosity because of our history. A generosity that's rooted in the first generosity of God. The motive for our generosity ought to be connected to the fact that God loved and blessed and saved and took care of us first. See, we are generous in response. Not trying to earn God's favor. Not trying to bend and manipulate any forces to benefit us, not because we feel like we have to be generous, because there's an obligation, because we're being forced to be generous. We're not trying to validate ourselves in front of other people by being generous. Instead, we are the people who have received generosity first, and then it flows out of us. It flows through us. This is our story. If you continue to read through the narrative of Scripture, through the decades and the generations and the centuries that pass as all of the different stories in this library are told, you eventually get to a point where the narrative starts to include you and me. You get to a point where Jesus, the Son of God, lives on earth, walks among us as a human, sacrifices his life on our behalf for the weaknesses and the failures and the sins and the mistakes and the problems and the propensities that humanity just can't solve on our own. And Paul tells us, he says, when sin kept getting worse, when sin increased, God's grace abounded all the more. When humanity kept getting worse, God kept getting better. God kept showing generosity when we deserved it less than we did the day before. God kept showing up. God kept providing. God kept saving. And God kept carrying us through. And now here we are. And our story is that we are a people who have come to recognize God's provision in our lives. And it leads to a life of contentment and thankfulness. And it leads to a life of response. It leads to a life where we start to recognize all of that history and all of those passages and all of those, everything that happened that God did. And we start to say, how can I be a part of that? How can I respond? That's the mark of people who have had a real experience with God. 1900 years ago, there was a Greek philosopher named Aristides. In around the second century, so we're talking about the year 125 or so, he gave a speech to Emperor Hadrian, the Roman emperor at the time, And he had done kind of a study, kind of an inventory of all of the major religious groups that were cropping up and making their presence known in the Roman Empire. He was giving the emperor an inventory of the religious activity in his empire. And he talked about Jews, and he talked about a bunch of different Roman cults, and he talked about paganism, and he talked about idol worshipers. He talked about Scythians, and he talked about Christians. And he had spent some time among the Christians in the second century. But what Hadrian didn't know, Emperor Hadrian didn't know, is that in his time of study, Aristides was starting to become convinced of the truth of the Christian message. I want to read you just a portion of what Aristides said to Emperor Hadrian about the Christians. Emperor Hadrian, I've noticed this among the Christians, that he who has gives to him who has not without boasting about it. And when Christians see a stranger, they take him into their homes and they rejoice over him as their brother. They're not brothers in the flesh, but brothers after the Spirit and in God. And whenever one of their poor members passes away in this world, each one of the Christians, according to their ability, cares for that family and sees to the burial and makes sure that that happens. And if the Christians hear about somebody in their number who's imprisoned or afflicted on account of the name of their Messiah, all of them anxiously minister to that need. And if it's possible to redeem him, if it's possible to pay the bail, they work together to set him free. And if there's somebody among them that's poor and needy, that doesn't have anything to eat, all of the rest of them fast for 2 or 3 days in order to supply to the needy for their lack of food. And Aristides studied these people, and he watched the way that they treated one another, and he watched the way that they treated the people who had nothing to give them. He watched the way that they cared, and he said, I want to be a part of that. And it was because of the way that they lived generously. His life was changed, and his story is recorded for us, not because he was famous, not because he was a philosopher, but because he became a Christian, converted and changed by the lives of generosity that he was watching other Christian people live. He said, I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of the kind of community that if I was sick, they would gather around my bedside. If I was hungry, they would make sure that I had something to eat, even if it meant that they had to go without for a while. I want to be a part of the kind of community that if my spouse dies, if somebody in my family dies, they're going to show up and they're going to help me and they're going to walk with me and they're going to grieve with me and they're going to help me with the funeral and the burial and all of that kind of stuff. He says, I want to be a part of that kind of community. And it's amazing to me that that's what the Christians became known for. That's what the reputation of Christians was most famous for, was that they were generous, that they were selfless, that they lived sacrificially, and that they cared for one another. I don't know what you think the reputation of Christians is in our community these days, but I'd like to see that be more emphasized. I'd love for Christians to be known as the people who live in an uncommon generosity, an unbelievable generosity that testifies to the fact that we know God is never going to let us down. And I'd like it to be known that it's still a free will offering. That we're not generous because we have to be. We're not generous because we feel like it earns us some new status with God, that God suddenly loves us more. We're generous because we know that God has already shown His love to the fullest extent on our behalf. We're generous because God has already been generous to us. Paul put it this way in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. He said, each of you should give what you have decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly and not under compulsion. You don't have to do this. You should do it based on what you've decided in your heart to give, what you've been moved to give, what you're willing to give, because God loves a cheerful giver. This is the story God's inviting us to. The story that mirrors our story with God. Because what God did was He came and He made Himself a servant. And He laid down His life so that our lives would be better. And He's calling us to come and pour out everything about ourselves, everything that we own, everything that we have, everything we control, all of our time, all of our talent, all of our resources. He's calling us to subject all of that to the needs of the world around us. To be people who are generous because generosity was given to us first. And we want to take steps as a church to get there. It's the reason we do things like Financial Peace University, so that the kinds of things that have happened in our history with our finances don't continue to be a roadblock for us as we try to live generously. It's the reason that we share benevolence offering with people in our community and organizations in our community that help the poor. It's the reason that we work so hard for events like Feed the Need, the food donation thing that you can get information about today out in the lobby, because we want the world to know that we're generous because generosity was given to us first.